This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, we're looking at campus attitudes today on government, war, and civic duty. But first, the real price of oil. Oil supports the economies of the Middle East and North Africa, but at what cost? I spoke with James Surowiecki, financial columnist for The New Yorker, earlier today. I asked him about what economists call the resource curse.
It's this kind of curious thing, which is we normally think of natural resources as this very good thing. If you read textbooks, for example, the phrase is usually, you know, the country is blessed with natural resources.
Sure.
And so we normally think if you have a lot of oil or coal or gold or any of these things, that's a good thing for an economy. But the truth is, when you look at the numbers, in other words, when you look at countries that are very, very rich in natural resources, that get a very large percentage of their national incomes from natural resources, what you find is that they are actually not the richest countries. In fact, for the most part, they're among the poorer countries. And more importantly, their economic growth, that is to say how fast their economy grows over time, is in some cases non-existent and for the most part is minimal. So that's this paradox is kind of why is this situation? And that's sort of what the resource curse tries to explain.
And, so connect that to September 11th for us. Why are you bringing this up in the context of people's search for understanding?
Well, one of the things that's become clear, I think, over the last, say, month and a half or so, is that the effort against terrorism, say, broadly speaking, is going to be not just a military one, but will presumably also be an economic one and certainly an international one. And Colin Powell, for example, has spoken quite a bit about sort of the need to fight poverty and to sort of deal with the economies of the Middle East, almost all of which are basket cases. I mean, almost without exception, the economies of the Middle East, North Africa, and obviously South Asia, where Afghanistan is, are really in trouble and have been for a very long period of time.
But the Middle East floats on an ocean of oil.
Right. And that's sort of the paradox. So the question is, here you have this, you know, very rich region in terms of its natural resources, and yet you have this remarkable poverty. And you know, the Saudi Arabia, take a great example. Saudi Arabia in 1980, its per capita income was about the same as a lot of Western European countries. It was literally as rich as say, West Germany or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Today, its per capita income is about a fourth of where it was in 1980. And the obvious reason for that is that oil prices are significantly lower than they were in 1980, adjusted for inflation, et cetera, et cetera. The question, though, is why? And there's this sort of multifarious answers, but that I think are really interesting and really important. One of them is that because countries become dependent on natural resources, they tend not to expand into other fields. For example, they don't industrialize, which is the most obvious example. And that has a cost because one of the good things about industrialization is actually that you get to learn while you're doing it. In other words, the classic example would be a country that, say, starts off very low on the ladder. Say it builds a textile factory and, you know, makes khakis or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, it starts to make khakis. It gets good at making khakis. It becomes integrated into the international community. It, you know, trades with other countries, et cetera, et cetera. And then as it does so, it starts to get smart. It starts to learn things about how to run factories. It starts to learn things about how to play the world market in terms of what – and it also starts to learn what other goods it might make and that people need. And then it moves up the ladder. And – you know, the great examples of this are the Asian countries. If you went back to 1960, a country like Korea or a country like Taiwan, these were countries that were, you know, very poor, that seemed to have very little growth prospects. And today, I mean, they're literally industrial powerhouses. And what they did was they quite literally moved up the ladder. They started with textiles and they moved to, say, you know, assembling consumer electronics. Then they started making consumer electronics and they started building computers. And, you know, now Taiwan supplies all the semiconductor chips in the world.
So you're saying when we try to figure out what's going on in the Middle East, don't look to Western exploitation or Arab corruption or Islamic hostility. Look to oil.
Right. I think that's has a huge impact. One other thing I mentioned is that, and that I think has a lot to do with it, is in Arab countries right now, I think there's a real sense that wealth is something that you take. That is, you get wealth by taking it either from the earth or from other people. And you don't have that kind of entrepreneurial spirit, which basically says wealth is something you create. You go out and you, you know, turn labor into something valuable. And I think that, again, if most of your income comes from oil, which is, of course, taken out of the ground, it tends to diminish that sort of entrepreneurial spirit.
But some resource-rich countries have avoided this resource curse trap.
Right.
How?
Well, I'll give you one example that I didn't mention in the piece, and that is the United States. And that's an interesting example because the United States obviously is very rich in natural resources and always has been. The United States avoided it essentially by using its natural resources as levers for industrialization and to expand into other areas. So, you know, for example, we had a lot of cheap oil, but we use that as the foundation for our chemical industry. And countries that have done this in like the 80s and the 1990s have followed a similar pattern. Essentially, what they've done is bracket off their oil revenue, and they've said, we're going to use this for what we can in terms of, you know, helping fund government spending, et cetera, et cetera. But the real source of economic growth is going to come from industry. And they've done things like they spent a lot of money on education because education is obviously crucial to the world economy today. They've set up free trade zones so that, you know, to facilitate the export of goods. And they've invested heavily in sort of their industrial sectors.
And what about the countries that we're so concerned about now? Are they doing these things, investing in education, investing in manufacturing?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, almost without exception, the countries in the Middle East, their literacy rates are remarkably low. Obviously, part of that is because women in general are not educated in a lot of these countries. Manufacturing, Saudi Arabia right now, its national income, 70 to 80% of it comes from oil. So if we're seriously thinking about how we can sort of, you know, ameliorate the poverty and act to change the state of affairs in the Middle East, you have to look to getting those countries off essentially the oil addiction that they're on.
James Surowiecki is financial writer for The New Yorker. They're supposed to rebel, burn their books, their bras, the flag, sit in at the dean's office, protest on the Washington Mall. At least that's what their baby boomer parents did when they were in school. But today's college undergrads are a whole new generation. They trust the president, support military action, and say, yeah, they'll serve if the draft calls. That's the finding of a new national survey just completed by students at Harvard's Institute of Politics. To help us take the temperature on college campuses, we're joined in the studio tonight by two students who worked on the survey. Erin Ashwell is a senior at Harvard and was a co-chair of the study. Welcome, Erin.
Well, thank you for having us.
My pleasure. And Peter Buttigieg is a sophomore at Harvard, and he helped design the study. Hi, Peter.
Hi, glad to be here.
So, here's the question. What's behind these polling numbers? We'll dive into them in a second. But what is driving this new generation on America's college campuses? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Erin Ashwell, paint a little picture of us. We had some numbers at the top of the hour, but give us the picture of American college students today. What are their attitudes about government, about civic life, and about the war that we're in now?
Well, the interesting thing is that this generation supports the war, maybe not as adamantly as the general population, as full-fledged adults. But if you talk to students, 4 out of 5 support U.S.-led airstrikes in Afghanistan. More than 2/3 are in favor of the use of ground troops. And so maybe support is a little bit lower in college students, but it's still remarkably high when you think of past college generations that have, you know, burnt down books or whatever else.
Mm-hmm. Give us the comparison between college students then and the general population around some of these issues. At the top of the hour, we were talking about how gung-ho this generation was. And granted, that's really in contrast to past generations. They are not as supportive of the war as the general population. What do those numbers look like? Erin, Peter?
Well, we don't have any numbers, actually, from the Vietnam era. And I think it's a really interesting question because if you're comparing this to the Vietnam era, what year are we in? Are we in 1962? Are we in 1960? People tend to look at the Vietnam era and only look at the protest. It took a while for that to materialize. So maybe if something goes drastically wrong in Afghanistan, this college generation will change.
But let's look today at how their attitudes compare with the general population. You cited in your study some of the numbers. Give us the specific numbers for college students and for the general population around the war issues.
Well, we see that 92% of the population supports U.S. airstrikes, and we only have about 79% of college students supporting the airstrikes.
So a strong majority, but less than the overwhelming majority in the general population.
Yeah, it tends to be about 10 to 20% below. 80% of the general population supports the use of ground troops. Only 68% of college students are supporting that same action. So it's some lower.
And then there's the number on those who would be ready to serve if the draft were reinstated. Now, of course, this is something that applies to college-age students and not to the general population, really. How does that break down young men and young women and their attitudes?
Well, it's really surprising. 49% of women actually say that they would dodge the draft. It's hard to say what's behind that. Something apocalyptic would probably have to happen for women to be drafted.
Mm-hmm.
Men are much more likely to say that they would go if drafted. It's about 71%.
Mm-hmm. So that's high. That's a clear majority of guys who said, okay, if I'm drafted, I'll go.
And I would note that a fair percentage of those are saying that they would serve with reservations.
Mm-hmm. Were there degrees of enthusiasm for going to respond to the draft, Peter?
Yeah, it's something we didn't measure as much, but it is important to remember that we haven't completely abandoned the reservations of our parents' generation.
Mm-hmm.
If you just look at our own campus, we had an event that was a demonstration for peace, which drew about 500 people, not all of whom were necessarily against the war. As we've said, there's general support among students, but at the same time, people who were very critical and questioning and unsure. And then conservative groups on campus tried to hold a patriotism rally,
mm-hmm.
and drew only 50 students about a week or two later.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certainly some anxiety, a lot of questions. People aren't exactly sure how gung-ho they are. But at the same time, it's important to remember that we are, according to the survey, about 92% patriotic
in
varying
right?
degrees.
So that is active undergrad college students come back describing themselves in 92% as patriotic.
As patriotic, yeah. And that can mean different things to different people. I mean, there are a lot of students who think it's their patriotic duty to be critical and to be questioning.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, again, we do have also overwhelming support for the war in some form or another as it stands right now.
You did your survey in the middle of October when the emotions of September 11th were still very high. How much do you think that affected the numbers?
I think that had a huge effect. It's incredible just to look at the actions people have taken. 71% of college students in October said they'd given money or done some sort of relief for the World Trade Center. It's important to remember this is a national survey. It's not just people in the Northeast, but 71% of college students nationwide had taken
huge.
Some action.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's a response to a tragedy, a response to a very alarming event. Mm. What about in attitudes toward government and toward civic life in general, Peter?
We've been really surprised, pleasantly surprised, at the jump in trust and confidence in government that we've seen since the last time we measured college students last spring. We found that the number has almost doubled for trust in the federal government, from 36% in 2000 to 60% now. It's still unclear whether that's going to be a sort of spike associated with the events of September 11th, but we're hoping that in the future we'll be able to draw out the survey and see if this holds long term. There's also increased trust for the military, for the president, even Congress, which is traditionally unpopular among students, is surprisingly high.
What are some of the numbers around the trust of the military in particular?
Well, the military is the most outstanding number. 75% of students at this point say that they have confidence in the military to do the right thing.
To do the right thing, sort of whatever that may be.
We described it as doing the right thing all or most of the time.
Mm-hmm. And the president, the Congress?
The president's at 69% and the Congress at 62%, both of which are pretty extraordinary given the climate over recent years.
How do those compare with student numbers from the year 2000?
Again, the general number has almost doubled since 2000.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have handy the numbers for the president and the Congress, Aaron.
Mm-hmm. But you're looking at just about a doubling in trust across the board.
Something like that.
And it's really surprising because when we first planned to make the study, it was before the September 11th tragedy, and we were looking at what are going to be the results of the most recent election scandal,
mm-hmm.
Which college students seem, we thought, would react very violently to.
You're talking about the close vote in Bush's ultimate Supreme Court decided victory.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And so instead of seeing decreased trust because of voting problems, we mm-hmm. see this enormous trust for government.
Do students today think of themselves as conservative?
That's a very interesting question because the number of independents, we have about 40% of students are independents. So they're not going either for a conservative or liberal standpoint. In many ways, I think that we tend to cut down the middle. We're fiscally conservative but socially liberal. And in that way, neither party really speaks to us.
Mm. But ready, in this case, after September 11th, to go to war. We're looking at a new survey done by students at Harvard of students nationwide and the new attitudes of a new generation of American college students. What's going on with America's youth? Boomers, do you recognize your children and college students? What are the hot issues and attitudes on your campus? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be back in just a few minutes. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a new generation of college students that is ready to stand up, wave the flag, and if necessary, go to war. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-4223-TALK. What do you make of this new generation and its attitudes? Where do you think they spring from exactly? What's it going to mean for the country to have a generation coming out of college with a pro-government, pro-military view of the world? We're joined tonight by Aaron Ashwell and Peter Buttigieg. They've just helped complete a national survey of college students done by the Harvard Institute of Politics that's found some really remarkable numbers about how ready students are to stand up and support the government, stand up and say they're patriots, and if drafted, go to war. Join our conversation. Aaron, we were talking in the break about how your survey findings break down by region. Were there regional differences in attitudes among students north, south, east, west?
In some ways, it almost looks like the election map after the most recent election.
The blue and the red?
Yeah, with the break in the middle and then the south and then the coasts sort of going more liberal. What we found is that students in the Northeast are less likely to support military action. Students in the South are more likely to be patriotic and are more likely to be in favor of the military action. And in the Midwest, there is also more support for the military.
What about racial breakdown or racial lines? Did any emerge? Any distinctions?
It was very interesting to look at the trust numbers. We found that 10% of African-American college students never trust the president. Even after the September 11th tragedy, 10% absolutely never trust the president.
Is there any echo of that in the white or Latino communities?
The white community tends to have more trust for the government in general. We had a general Hispanic category, tends to have more trust in the military, but not so much in other parts of government.
Mm-hmm. Peter, when you talk to students or talk to your own parents, how do you see them responding to what students are saying today? I mean, everybody knows the famous images of Vietnam War protest. And granted, Aaron Ashwell, as you point out, that wasn't in 1962 and were early days in this war. Who knows how it will all develop? But are students consciously aware that they have attitudes that are more in line with the government than their parents' at least stereotype picture of their parents' generation?
Well, certainly as students, and because our parents were of that generation, we're familiar with the imagery of rebellion and that kind of concept of youth. I think it's important to remember the real distinction between the causes of going to war, and that Vietnam is remembered in our history as a very divisive historical event, whereas the word you keep hearing when we talk about September 11th is it's united the nation. We're all coming together around that. And I think because of that, you find that there's a little less of this feeling of a need for rebellion in the mind of the student right now.
Mm-hmm. We've got callers who want to join our conversation. Let's bring them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the college student generation right now and how they're responding to everything that's unfolding since September 11th. 1-800-423-TALK. Jeb is on the line. Welcome, Jeb. You're on the air.
Is this my name is Jeff. Is that who you're...
Yes, Jeff. Sorry.
Yes.
Welcome.
I'm glad to hear that you're discussing this. But I'm a bit curious about the study that was made, and I wonder how deep it really went, because, in fact, I'm from that generation. I'm 60 years old, and I recall that in the early days, in 62, 63, there was not much protest against the war at that time. In fact, youth were joining up.
Mm-hmm.
I know that now a young man who was who I'm quite close to decided to join the Marines. This is now. And he thought that he was getting into a group that was going to save people and help them out and do really good things for them.
Mm-hmm.
He got halfway through boot camp, and he called me up frantic. He realized that what they were really going to be doing was killing people.
Mm-hmm. That is the job of Marines, isn't it?
I said to him, that's what I was trying to tell you. I fought to keep people out of the Army to give that... to destroy the draft in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to explain this to him before he joined up. And and he did not put it together. And I'm afraid that a lot of this, the reactions were because of the advertising, because of the kind of propaganda that people are seeing now. And eventually they're going to come to some kind of understanding about what the truth is.
Jeff, thanks for your call. Sorry, Jeff. Let's put your observation to the students who are right here with us, and thank you for your call. Here you can see this kind of expectation from a boomer caller saying, well, you're patriotic now, you're supporting the government now, but just you wait. You'll come around. Is there anything in the numbers that would suggest already that that might be true, or is this really just a different generation?
It's really impossible to say from the numbers right now. If you look at the data, 34% of college students say that the government should have done more in terms of diplomacy in trying to resolve the situation.
How does that compare with the general population?
It's much smaller.
I think it was 14%, if I recall, of general population said there should have been more diplomacy done. 32% of students would have liked to see more diplomacy. So that means there really was more reluctance at the outset to go in without a big diplomatic effort.
And the emphasis among students has been that this needs to be a just war. And if this war does turn ugly down the road, I think people's attitudes could very swiftly change. But it's really hard to say at this point. I'd like to point out, this is going to be an annual study. So maybe this time next year, we'll have some more answers on that.
Yeah, year by year, we'll tell a lot here. But right now, the numbers are remarkable. Jeff, thank you for your call. Who knows how it's all going to evolve? I want to reach out now to a different part of the country and bring in another college student, Taryn Hodison. Taryn's the state and national news editor of the Maneater, the student newspaper at the University of Missouri, Columbia. Hi, Taryn.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
I hope you've heard some of our conversation here. We're looking at a new survey that shows pretty conservative, pro-military, pro-government attitudes among students, undergraduate students. What are you finding on your campus at the University of Missouri, Columbia?
Well, I'm finding that a lot of students here are they are very supportive of the government action so far, of what we're doing, and they are willing to sort of go the extra mile to help out the country in this time. But I'm also finding that some students are, as we sort of get farther from September 11th, a lot of students are sort of thinking, well, how is this going to affect me? You know, being very, for lack of a better word, very gung-ho about this whole thing. It's our generation that's going to have to fight in this war, and I think a lot of students are starting to think about that, at least on this campus, and are kind of getting concerned about that. And they're not as enthusiastic about going, you know, about fighting as they were.
Taryn, do you think that's because of the images coming out of Afghanistan that make the reality of war more clear, or is it concern about the just or lack of justice in the conflict?
I think a lot of it is just people becoming more rational about the situation. When it first happened, everyone or most people were really outraged and angry. And now that we see what we're up against as far as terrorism, it's not just Afghanistan, it's not just the Taliban. This could be a very long, drawn-out conflict. And I just think it's a realization that this is going to be harder than people first imagine. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to note, your student newspaper there has quite a fierce name itself, the Maneater. What stories have you been covering there on your campus related to the war?
Well, there is an organization both on campus and in the city of Columbia. It's called Mid-Missouri Peace Works, and they work with a group called Students for Progressive Action, and they often hold forums that basically question our efforts in Afghanistan. And a few weeks ago, there was a protest at Whiteman Air Force Base, which is where they house the B-2 stealth bombers.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 100 miles outside of the city. And
Those are the ones that have flown all the way to Afghanistan to do some early bombing runs.
Yes, that's right. And they held a protest there on Veterans Day, and we covered that story.
Have you seen much support, though, for these protests or not?
Yeah, I would say that there are a lot of people. I wouldn't say that the majority of students would go that far, you know, to participate in a protest like this. But I've seen support. I've seen a lot of people out there saying, wait a minute, you know, is this the right course of action that we should be taking? And there are a lot of students, I think, that are hesitant or who are hesitant to, you know, sign up or enlist and put their lives in the line, and for something that they honestly, I don't think, know a whole lot about.
Taryn, what about foreign students? When the student body is generally gung-ho, as you say, for the war and quite supportive of it, how's that affected international students at your school? Are they feeling comfortable or are they taking off?
Well, right about a week after the attacks, 45 international students left our university, and that wasn't necessarily unique to MU or to University of Missouri. It sort of happened all over the country, but there was that initial feeling that either the parents of these international students or the international students themselves didn't feel safe. And we haven't had a steady, you know, progression of students leaving since, but right after, you know, the attacks happened, 45 international students, that's quite a lot. We have 1,300 here.
So it's a noticeable chunk of the student population.
Right, and just coming so closely to the attacks, it was pretty obvious what was going on, and it was pretty startling to a lot of people, I would say.
Taryn, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Taryn Hodison is national news editor of The Maneater, the student newspaper at the University of Missouri, Columbia. Aaron Ashwell here in our studio, what do you hear in Taryn's report from the heartland there that strikes a chord with you?
Well, you said earlier that you see this as a somewhat conservative generation. I don't think that's accurate. I think that this generation is more concerned with treating people right, and whether that means getting some sort of justice from Afghanistan, or, as our survey has suggested, an increased focus on patriotism as public service through volunteerism and community, and if the case may be protesting outside of an Air Force base that they think is doing something unjust. I think that's a much better characterization of this generation than just necessarily conservative and pro-military.
Wanting people treated right.
And that's a very, I guess, kind of simple way of saying it, but
well,
I think that's what's
fine.
There. We see about over 60% of college students do some form of community service.
Mm-hmm. And it's very high.
So I think that is sort of a new definition of patriotism for this generation.
We're talking about a new generation of college students and their definitions of patriotism, their view of the war, their view of their government. The numbers are high compared to what their parents might have been late in the Vietnam War. How does it all look to you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Carolyn is on the line. Welcome, Carolyn. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
Just a couple of things. One is my husband and I became Quakers as a result of the Vietnam experience.
Mm-hmm.
And have found that supportive throughout this whole process of being an entity that was consistently peace-oriented. I have a son at the University of Rochester, and I think that one of the issues that come up for kids, I think in response to what the last speaker said, is the role of women in Afghanistan has made it very appealing to sort of hold back. And
what do you mean hold back, Carolyn?
To hold back on the criticism because of the status of women and how dismal it is. And
so it might bring out some support of the war because women were in such a tough position there.
Right. But I want to also get back to the survey a little bit because I think some of the analysis that you all are giving to the survey emphasizes, I think you said pro-military, pro-government a couple of minutes ago. I would be interested, I mean, you said it was a national survey. I'd be interested in some of the numbers and the methodology and, you know, did they do a good job to get really reliable results? But also, I think that in some of the analysis, I think the numbers were 71% of the young men said that they would serve.
That's right. Serve draft if the draft was
right.
They'd go if they were called by the draft.
Right. And in my mind, the really interesting number there is that 29% wouldn't. 29% theoretically at this point with the high emotions in this country are saying that they would break the law. You didn't get close to 29% of the people in the Vietnam War. I don't believe. I don't have numbers. Opposing not opposing it, but actually taking a hike on serving.
Fair enough. There are a lot of nuances here, and we want to acknowledge those.
I guess what I'm saying is on some of the flip sides to some of the numbers, that's the one that stood out for me, I think are really where the more interesting story is, because I think people would be stunned if they thought almost 30% of the kids would say, I won't serve. But I, as a last plug I want to make, and I do want to hear their comments on the methodology, next weekend, December, the night of December 7th and December 8th, Tufts University Peace Studies Program and the American Friends Service Committee are doing a major conference on these kinds of issues, and I would certainly encourage people who are interested to check it out.
Great. Carolyn, thanks very much for your call. Peter, can you speak to the methodology? You surveyed 1,200 students nationwide. Tell us a little bit about the mechanics of how you went about it.
Sure. Well, we're actually very confident in our numbers. The survey was carried out by SWR Worldwide, which is a major polling firm that does a lot of work for a lot of different clients in New York, Boston, and Washington. we made sure that we had professional pollsters working on this because there are so many nuances to having a survey in order to make sure that it's scientifically accurate. So we are very confident in our numbers, and the sample size was very large to make sure we had a pretty good picture. It's true there are a lot of nuances. For example, when we say pro-military, pro-government, it puts us kind of between a rock and a hard place if we're going to try and use the old conservative liberal dialectic, because pro-government sounds liberal and pro-military sounds conservative.
Mm-hmm. It did once upon a time.
So it's a very tricky thing. And one of the things we found is that a lot of students have felt possibly a negative effect from a whole generation of politicians and media telling us government's bad, centrist rhetoric, the era of big government is over.
Mm-hmm.
And now maybe we have something that may restore our confidence in government and hopefully get people a little more civically engaged.
I can feel the optimism in your voice as you describe that. Carolyn is objecting, or at least wanting us to look at the fact that, of course, if 75% are for something, that leaves 25% who are not, and we acknowledge that up and down the line. Still, compared to a generation 25 or 30 years ago, these are strongly supportive numbers. We have more callers on the line. Let's try and get one more in before the next break. Benjamin is calling. Welcome, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Good evening. How are you?
We're well, thank you.
Good, thank you. I'm a graduate student at Tufts University here in the Boston area. And what's occurred to me since listening to this is that the discussion in the study is framed to suppose that opposition to war is sort of this responsibility or burden of college students. I don't think that's the case. I agree, however, that healthy skepticism, or as one of their guests pointed out, the critical ability which you would think university education would inculcate in students is important. My comment, however, is that the nature of college education has changed dramatically, I think, in the past 30 years.
In what way, Benjamin?
I believe now that the college is more a rite of passage for this American middle class, and I think that concurrent with the other changes in our culture, the level of education, the level of articulation, the level of study itself has declined. And I think, along with that, I think students' abilities have declined, their abilities to look at things critically, their ability to ask pertinent questions and to challenge certain assumptions.
Benjamin, thanks for your call, and we'll put that to our guests right here in the studio, who are giving you some pretty glowering facial response here. But we're going to have to take a break first. We're talking about a new generation of U.S. college students. Our caller says, what about their critical facilities? Why aren't they against the war? We'll come back and talk about that after a break. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're looking at the results of a new national survey done by the Harvard Institute of Politics students there that says students are fairly supportive right now of the war. What do you think is behind that? Where are we going to go? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about a new generation of college students and their reaction to what's going on in the war on terrorism. The numbers show that they're supportive right now of the war on terrorism, supportive of the government, less so than the general population, more so likely than their parents were 25 or 30 years ago. What does it all mean? How do we pick apart the character of this new generation? We're joined by Aaron Ashwell and Peter Buttigieg. They're from Harvard's Institute of Politics, and they've just worked on a big national survey of students that brought in some very interesting numbers. Aaron, just before the break, we had a caller asking about the framing of the poll itself and the assumptions there.
Well, just as a basic note, the goal of our survey is to track attitudes towards government. And, of course, the war was extremely relevant this time. But what we began with a year and a half ago, the first time we ran the survey, was that students didn't find government relevant. And now our basic surprise is that students are finding government so important.
It changed within 1 year or so.
In about 18 months.
Mm-hmm. And Peter, there was also the notion that students might simply not be critical or overwhelmingly critical now because they have lower critical facilities than a generation ago. What do you think of that, young man?
Well, the caller does raise a valid concern, which is whether college is shifting toward a pre-professional activity instead of an intellectual one. It's something that I think a lot of people worry about, but I don't share his belief, obviously, that our critical faculties are gone. I think that while there is a culture that's often steering us toward college as a sort of next step on the road to financial or other kinds of success, if you just saw some of the discussions that I know went on around my campus and many of the other campuses around the country, some that would be considered conservative places, about just what are we doing? Are we doing the right thing? Should we slow down? Let's look at this. There were very critical responses coming from all angles. One of the most interesting things to me, at least in the Boston area, was the response with the Muslim community and students sort of trying immediately to build a relationship to make sure that they were sensitive to a lot of the racial tensions, anxieties, and international issues that were going to come up and that we were going to feel right here at home.
We also had this issue raised in the call, and it's an interesting one, of whether opposition to war, in this case, is the responsibility of students. And I hear you saying something different here, that there's idealism here, but it's not necessarily pre-programmed to be opposition. It's looking through its own sights here.
I think that students have the responsibility to believe what they believe. And I think this generation is very idealistic. And as I said earlier, I think this generation has a new definition of patriotism. It's not the same sort of pro-military patriotism that you see on maybe different Veterans Days. Mm-hmm. But this is a patriotism that's very tied to serving other people through community service. And I think that that outlook comes out into student discussions about war. And that's where the responsibility of students lies.
Let's bring in one more perspective here. We're joined now by Tim Kudo. He's editor-in-chief of the Daily Bruin, the student newspaper at the University of California, Los Angeles. Welcome, Tim Kudo.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well, thanks. We're talking about your generation tonight, Tim. Tell us about the response at UCLA right after the attacks. What was the initial response to what was going on there, and how has it unfolded in the couple of months since then?
Well, during the time right after the attacks, we weren't actually in session. We were just coming to the end of our summer, and initially the administration was doing a lot in terms of they set up a vigil and things like that, and they set up a series of classes, some seminar classes, to deal with, you know, issues surrounding the attack that professors would do. And then once school started, our undergraduate student government held a small vigil. There have been sporadic protests, but nothing very large, and for the most part, it's been pretty quiet, basically.
Do you see a surge in patriotic attitudes among students? And what does that mean, patriotism, in the context of UCLA?
Yeah, I think there has been. I mean, if you walk around some of the student housing and things like that, you see flags hanging from windows and from balconies and, you know, pins of, you know, red, white, and blue pins on backpacks and things like that. I don't know necessarily if what this generation viewing how this generation views patriotism is different than previous generations. I mean, I think that whoever said the point about that more of a care of the human condition and how that affects the government, how that relates to the government, I think is obviously a concern. And when people look at the government now and they talk about patriotism, they're talking about benefit for all, be it, you know, Middle Easterners who may be being picked up by the FBI or, you know, Afghan women as well, and how our war and our foreign policy affects that, as well as Afghanis who may be Taliban members or just, you know, men in Afghanistan. So, I mean, I think the approach is much more concentrated on human rights and things like that, and however that relates to patriotism and government in America.
Tim, do you, in your conversations with your friends or with your parents, do you sense that that the parental generation here is surprised by the student support at this point? Or they just see it as a natural outgrowth of looking at the situation that people are facing right now in 2001, not 1971.
I think, you know, they're trying to make this comparison with the Vietnam War, and I mean, I think there's a quick move to that and look at students in terms of Vietnam where there is these massive protests. But a more appropriate maybe relevance might be to World War II or something like that, where there was an attack on America, so that, you know, students who might otherwise, you know, have strong opposition or resistance to a war or to government, you know, in this case, in some ways feel threatened, in some ways feel attacked themselves, and maybe feel a need for retribution as well. So I don't think that the adult generation looks at the support necessarily, you know, as comparing it to Vietnam War, or not everyone at least.
And that may not be the most appropriate lens. And what about these old labels of conservative and liberal? Do you hear those even coming up in student conversations at UCLA?
Well, always. I mean, that's a notable part of a political campus.
But what do they mean now?
What do they mean now?
Well, in relation to the war, let's say.
I mean, I think it kind of holds a traditional value. I mean, we have liberal people writing into our newspaper talking about, you know, the need to maybe approach diplomacy first at all costs before, you know, military action. But at the same time, and, you know, conservatives talking about the need to go and bomb Afghanistan and looking more at a foreign policy perspective. But at the same time, I mean, those lines get kind of blurred, and it becomes a lot more about single-issue politics and, you know, looking at the rights of Afghan women and versus the need to go on, you know, to maybe use diplomacy. And those lines get blurred, and, you know, they are less hesitant to oppose the war because of the plight of Afghani women. And, you know, general things like that. It becomes much more single-issue.
Mm-hmm. Tim Kudo, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you.
Tim Kudo is editor-in-chief of the Daily Bruin, the student newspaper at UCLA. We've got callers who want to come in here, and our time's running short. Let's turn to the phones once more. Sandra is on the line. Hi, Sandra.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
We're great. What's your question or comment?
Well, I have a few quick comments. I'm on the student newspaper at Framingham State College.
Good to have you.
And I wasn't a part of it, but a survey was done in around late September to early October of a sizable portion of students. And the survey basically said, the results said that the majority of students are supporting the military. They're supporting the government, but that's only going to last as long as there are humanitarian efforts. And as soon as human rights start being violated, then their support of the government is going to drop.
So it's contingent upon the sense that the war is a just war and being fought in a just way.
Exactly. And like the gentleman who was just on said, I think that you cannot compare college students' reactions today to that of our parents back with the Vietnam War, because they're two completely different situations, two completely different wars. And this time it was on our own territory.
Sandra, thanks very much for your call. Our time's running down, but I just want to ask each of our guests here in the studio, I don't know if this is fair, but when you talk with your own parents, how do your attitudes jive or differ from theirs? Erin?
I find that I'm very much a product of my parents' attitudes, and we tend to have similar views, although they are much more likely to think of this actually in terms of World War II. But that's also a comparison that I'm worried about, because this isn't a traditional state war. We're not – currently we are fighting a nation. We're fighting Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But our war is on a terrorist network. And so I'm very nervous about comparing this to World War II or to Vietnam War, because this is a completely different type of war.
Mm-hmm. It sure is. And Peter, how about your conversations with your parents? Do you find that you're on the same wavelength or not?
I find, like Erin, that I share a lot of things in common with my parents. I mean, obviously, we've been largely molded in our world outlook.
And even in your response to September 11th and its aftermath?
For the most part. I mean, it's important to remember also, even though we say our parents' generation might be surprised to see us very supportive, that statistically, mom and dad are more supportive of this than we are. Even.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So it's important to remember that.
Gosh, I want to thank you both for coming in tonight. It's been a really interesting hour. I as your surveys unfold, I hope we can talk about them again. Erin Ashwell was co-chair of Harvard Institute of Politics' 2001 Survey of College Students, and Peter Buttigieg helped design that survey and carry it out in mid-October. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage Forum. Thanks to you both. Since September 11th, many Americans have dived into books, newspapers, and the TV news, hoping to understand the complex changes the nation and the world are undergoing. It's an impulse that Gail Pryor has experienced before, when her own life changed in an instant. But there's a time, she says, when one must turn off the TV, put down the books, and accept what may be difficult to fully understand.
Like so many women, like so many mothers, I belong to a neighborhood reading group, a book club. Our September group meeting came a week after the attacks. That night, like all Americans, we sat stunned and mystified. The world had turned on a dime, and we didn't see it coming. We did not discuss the book we had read. Instead, we pulled out a globe to find Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. We selected our reading for October, V.S. Naipaul's records of his travels through Islamic countries, to be followed by Karen Armstrong's The Battle for God, along with watching ceaseless newscasts and reading headlines and attending a symposium or two. We were furiously seeking understanding, trusting that once achieved, understanding would explain, perhaps absolve, and eventually lead to a solution. We put our faith in reading and knowledge. My reading group's response to a global crisis was familiar to me. Twice before, my world has turned on a dime, and I responded in precisely the same way. When my first baby was born, new motherhood overwhelmed me, so I read. The books I turned to still line 6 feet of the top shelf of my library. Parent-infant bonding, the complete book of breastfeeding, the fussy baby, the self-calmed baby, 25 things every new mother should know, and more. I read them all. Then one day, I was done reading. I looked up from the pages of advice and into the day, into my baby's smile, into life itself. At last, I felt ready to brave my days without an armory of books and knowledge, ready to call my new life normal. I was no longer coping with something extraordinary, but living through ordinary days. Then, when that same baby was diagnosed with a disease that would last his whole life long, I buried myself in reading again, this time medical journals, research data, and books on living with chronic illness. I read and read and read until I was satiated with as much knowledge as I could hold. Months later, I stopped reading and looked up at my son. I saw a growing, laughing, leaping boy. Maintaining our son's health, managing this disease that sent us spinning 12 years ago, soon blended into our days. This response to crisis, immersion in information, usually helps when we are overwhelmed. If we can master the facts, we believe, we can take charge of the situation. In today's crisis, however, the one we all share, the more I read about terrorists, religious enmity, and the wounds of history, the more information I absorb, the less my fears are eased. This time, the facts, not the unknown, frighten me. The situation is so complex that I wonder if true understanding, at least by me, is even possible. Still, I suppose the next step in a global crisis is the same one that followed the fact-devouring stage in each of my personal crises. Acceptance. We are still coping with the extraordinary, war, danger, grief. I pray these things will never become ordinary and normal. We must never accept terror. We must always seek to understand. But the hope that knowing more will give us more control over the things that frighten us is a false hope. Acceptance is the hardest lesson of all, especially in our land of plenty, and we learn it over and over with each crisis, with every difficult passage. Raising children teaches it well. Illness teaches it better. Perhaps a war that reaches to our own cities will teach it best of all. Because the funny truth is, when we accept that life is not under our control, no matter how well-read we are, we open up to life's messy glory. We become acutely aware of the preciousness of each day. And with that awareness come glimpses of joy, a baby's smile, a teenager's wry humor, a spread of golden maple leaves across the lawn. It is time, for me at least, to look up from my reading and into the day, into the joy that is blessed ordinary life.
Gail Pryor lives in Belmont, Massachusetts. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email. The address is special@wbur.org. You can listen to other radio diaries on our website, log on to wbur.org, and click on Special Coverage.